Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Thanks for listening and being part of my podcast. I hope 2024 is kind to you. In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts, with a mixture of interesting and thought-provoking guests discussing the human side and impact of crime on all those involved, including the investigators. And I'd love for you to give me a review if you can. They're just a great help to me. I give my guests the opportunity to tell their story in their own words and how they remember an incident. It may not be how others remember it, which I ask you to please keep in mind. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, contact Lifeline or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Thank you.
With the proliferation of mobile phones, you wouldn't get one call, you'd get 50 to 100 about the same incident. So that creates and still creates a huge bottleneck.
In mid-1988, as part of my 12-month training phase, I did a six-month stint at D24 in Melbourne, which, looking back, it was pretty archaic, but it's all we knew and it's all we had. D24 was the Victoria Police Communications Centre until the mid to late 90s. D24 was where you went prior to promotion. In the old days, you'd start your new rank at D24 and then branch out or fan out to the suburbs or country, but it really was the heart of policing. D24 got its name from being in Corridor D, Room 24, of the Art Deco-styled Russell Street Police Complex. There were a handful of public servants in D24 back then, but all the call takers and dispatchers, they were sworn members, so members of police. And as a police call taker, you'd take the emergency call. You may not believe this, but this is how it was. You'd consult street maps. You'd flip through cards to verify the correct codes. You'd scribble down the details on a small, like those index cards. And once you'd written all the info down, you'd put the cards on a conveyor belt for the delivery to the police dispatch worker in the same room, who was in charge of the area where the incident was occurring or had occurred. So it was a really slow process, but in the day, it was pretty efficient. And I read somewhere that there was something like 3,000 to 4,000 police events a day back then. I can't imagine what it is today. When D24 was relocated in the mid to late 90s, it was the end of an era. And I do recall, and I have no doubt my guest today will recall as well, about the relocation, and it unearthed all these, not all these, but there was firearms found, there were drugs, there were other items of interest, let's say, secreted in walls, under old desks and anywhere else that you might be able to find, hide something that you didn't want found for whatever reason. Obviously, those items had been forgotten. The Russell Street Police Complex is now a 4-star hotel. The new Intergraph system was introduced in November 95, and it was a whole new world. A computer automatically identified and recommended the best and closest unit to respond, and it could convey all the information about the incident in under, I don't know, maybe 80 seconds, compared to minutes wasted with the old card system. So it was groundbreaking technology. And today's guest, former Chief Inspector Rob Bailey, we've had Rob on before, he was given the task of implementing a group of select people to investigate the potential to introduce computer-aided dispatch to the Victoria Police, which resulted in the decommissioning of D24 at Russell Street. Initially, Rob was the project manager, and by the end of the project, and after 6 years, he was the coordinator for somewhere in the region of like $360 million, the project. Rob was instrumental in getting this project up and running, but he had a number of obstacles to deal with going on behind the scenes. He cites issues such as corruption, bribes, political interference, and perjury, which led to what Rob refers to, I do apologise, as, quote, a bullshit royal commission, unquote. Strong words. But then Rob is not backward in coming forward and telling it as it is or as it was. And just to make it absolutely clear, these are Rob's recollections and memories, and it might make for some uncomfortable listening for some. So with that introduction, Rob, you don't need much of an intro, but I'm sure, I'm not sure where to start. So I think I'm just going to hand over the reins to you and let you off the leash. So off you go, Rob. Tell us about Intergraph.
Yeah, hello all. Yes, look, very interesting topic and one that I really wanted to articulate before I depart. There's a few things I want to get off my chest and perhaps clarify a little bit. But there were some very interesting facets to this particular project. And one of the things that I'm really very strong about is back in the day, Intergraph was slated, front pages of newspapers and headlines that Intergraph killed my children and all of that sort of stuff. Well, I want to put all of that straight. And I certainly at that time was in a position, and I am now, to be able to make it quite clear that 99% of the time that wasn't the case, and I'll give some very good examples. But getting back to Russell Street, I actually decommissioned most of D20 or all of D24, and most parts of Russell Street I was instrumental in, or I assisted in doing that. And what Noel says is quite true. Some of the things we found there were really quite groundbreaking. But I'll leave it at that. The other thing is with the conveyor belt, and Narelle described D24 quite accurately, and I've actually got a videotape of when just before I decommissioned D24, I've got an hour long tape of which I've had converted to a DVD of exactly how it operated with the name on the door, the number on the door, and the operators and all the back of house stuff and whatever, which is really the only one in existence. And I will eventually give it to the police museum. They've only just rehabilitated themselves, so I'll let them settle in and I'll pass that on and to the academy. But during the decommissioning, the conveyor belt, which is about 5 metres long where these cards were put on, when we took the conveyor belt out, there was approximately 80 to 90 cards that were underneath the conveyor belt that never made it to the dispatcher. And going through some of those cards, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. So if there's some people out there still waiting for a copper to appear for some really serious assault, I'm sorry, but they're not coming.
I can see how the cards would displace, but what was one of the most serious cards that you found that nobody actually ever attended?
I can't remember. I'm taking the fifth.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Go on. Yeah.
No, back in the day, as Noel, as you say, Noel, I put a group together. I was approached by Assistant Commissioner Ray Shuey back in the day. It was actually in January 1990. From memory, and he said, Rob, I want you to investigate computer-aided dispatch. So the whole project started off by looking at computer-aided dispatch which translated over the next 5 or 6 years into a total rebuild or rehash of D24, the whole communications. And you're quite right, I was the project manager for computer-aided dispatch, and my team consisted of Mark Eden and Annie McIntosh, Michael Keenan, Ken Sutherland, who was a public servant, unfortunately RIP Ken, and a couple of other supernumerary. Brian Burton came in on the project. Graham Teeson was at D24 at the time, and he played an integral role in the whole thing. He was the chief inspector at D24. So it was a major, major project. And during the process, and I'll go into it in some detail, but during the next few years, we worked out of an office in, which was another very good story, where they gave us a little, it was the old breathalyzer headquarters in Fenwick Street in Carlton, and which was opposite the Fenwick Hotel, which was handy. And it was just an old house, and we worked there, and there was a few funny stories there. The meeting room was actually at the Fenwick Inn Hotel. They were fantastic. We developed a very strong relationship with them, and when there was trouble in the hotel, we were only 10 paces away, so quite often we'd have a barbecue in the backyard, and we didn't cook it. They just bought everything. And they were really fabulous times. We had a ball, and it was I had a very relaxed in sort of environment, because I believe project groups, I wasn't a real I wasn't a hierarchical sort of person, which I think is needed in some of these projects anyway. And a few funny incidents happened. I remember Ray Shuey came in one day. I think it was Ray. Anyway, I was sitting out in the courtyard with a pair of jocks on, a can of VB with a long line going to the computer hanging out through the window, and he walked out and I said, Ray, you should have rung before you came. So it was a very relaxed, but we worked really hard. And We were investigating the feasibility of computer-aided dispatch, and we looked at all the overseas projects and whatever. And indeed, earlier than that, I'd been over in San Francisco was on another job doing some stuff, not police-related, but with the kids with Young Talent Time. And I had the opportunity to work with the police over there, and they already had computer-aided dispatch terminals in their cars. So we were way behind in terms of the technology. So we developed a business plan and wrote the specifications for a computer-aided dispatch to fit in with a new control room environment. And this was for all the emergency services, wasn't just for police. So I was sort of headed up a steering committee under the auspices of BEST, which is Jeff Spring and the Bureau of Emergency Services Telecommunications. And so I had a very high-level representation from all the other emergency services, and we met regularly at the meeting room at the Fenwick Hotel, and that was fantastic.
Can I just interrupt there? Yes, of course. Were you in your jocks while you were at these meetings, or did you actually get out of your jocks?
I was suitably attired, and my staff knew that if there was an official engagement, we put uniforms on. We fell short of saluting and calling me sir, but it was still a relaxed environment. I forged some really great friendships with senior members from the other emergency services, as we all did, and it was so it was good fun. But one of the things I remember is Ken Sutherland, who was he was a public servant and brilliant, brilliant fellow, very laconic sort of a fellow. And during the early days, we decided we should meet with command and explain to them what computer-aided dispatch was and how it fitted in with the whole communications environment. And so we had a meeting at this was mid-project, I guess. We had a meeting at Russell Street with all the ATs, and I sort of opened it with the strategies and whatever and some of the plans to implement all of this sort of stuff. And Ken got up and talked about the actual technology, and it was hilarious. It was so – it was just brilliant. He said to – this is the assistant commissioners and chief commissioner – and he said, what we've got at the moment in the Victoria Police, he said, we've got a little egg boiling over here called LEAP, which is the Force Corporate Database. And here we've got another one that was on the go at the time, another little egg over here boiling away, and that's called Station Management. And he said, what we've got over here is an egg we're boiling at the moment called CAD, but what we really want is an omelette. And that has lived in my memory ever since, because up until then, the Victoria Police, God bless them, really didn't understand, as we did, the need to integrate all of these particular environments together. So that was a bit of a battle. Now, on the way through, it became well known throughout all the industries that this group existed out in Fenwick Street, this little group, and I deliberately handpicked these people, and I did it for a reason. And I think it was the chief back in those days. I think it might have been Cal Glare. No, it was Neil Comrie. Sorry, and Neil. And I basically had open slather who I could pick, so I handpicked these people, and we're still. In fact, we've got a reunion on the 10th of April next week. With all of my staff who will all be there, and Jeff Spring, who was the head of BEST, the head of Motorola, which is Paul Guerrero, who's now, as you well know, is a well-known identity in Melbourne, and Gary Berto was a manager at Intergraph. So all of those people, including my staff, are getting together next Wednesday for lunch at the Ringwood Club. And if anyone's listening that I've missed out, well, it's at 12 noon. that probably is an indication of how we work together and how we joined all our talents together and worked very harmoniously. And I remember when BEST was first established under Jeff Spring, that he was appointed an office or as the director of the whole thing, and he was allocated an office in Flinders Street. And we got a phone call from him, and they didn't have a computer. So Michael Keenan took one of our computers down, so BEST ended up being a huge entity and became ESTA as we now know it. And they didn't even have a computer to start with, so he was pushing the proverbial uphill to start with. But he was delightful to work with, and Jeff will be there next. He'll be there next Wednesday, and we'll tell some funny stories, which I won't be relating here. But
we'll have to have another one in a couple of months or so, and get you to tell some of those stories, the ones that we can tell.
I'll tell the ones I can tell today, Norelle. But one of the things that people don't realise, with all manner of things, and even today, it is something that the public probably don't realise. But with the advent and the proliferation of mobile phones, I'll give you an example. Before mobile phones were really in play, and the first one was in 1987 in Victoria, it was $4,250. If people remember. The brick was $4,250. But during the 90s and now, hitherto you would get a person who would see an accident on, say, the freeway, and they would call it a phone box and call into D24 that there was an accident. So you might get one or two calls. With the proliferation of mobile phones, you wouldn't get one call. You'd get 50 to 100 about the same incident. So that creates and still creates a huge bottleneck of people who are doing the right thing, members of the public, but they should be mindful of the fact that it also creates a bottleneck at the other end, answering the same call. So that created its own difficulties. One of the other things, and I've got to say now that Intergraph, who won the project, and I'll get into some of how that came about, at that particular stage had 168 other sites across the world. And at that time they were and still are the BEST system. And they're still using that system today. So is the RACV. People don't realise that's an Intergraph system. So during that whole exercise, a lot of people who wanted to bid for this project would beat their path to the CAD office and try and sell their wares to us and their project management skills and all that sort of stuff. And, of course, they'd be we're going to take you out for lunch and let's do this and here's tickets to that and whatever. Well, I was very firm and I said, we're not going to lunch. We don't want any free tickets. We don't want free anything. Once the contract's been awarded, you're more than welcome to take us out for dinner and I'll bet you I don't see you if you don't win. So, but during that old exercise, and I'll leave the names out, I got wind that some of these potential providers were beating a door to one of the assistant commissioners' doors to try and do what they were trying to do to me or us.
Okay.
And so I went and saw that particular assistant commissioner, and I said, well, I'm aware of the fact that people are coming to see you and I feel very sorry for you because I'm sure you don't want it, but unless you want to run the project, that's got to stop. So they did stop it. I'm not being too critical because, you know, stuff like that happens all the time. But he certainly put a stop to that. And but some of these bidders, one of the criteria that we needed was that they needed, you know, given that we're involving ambulance, fire, police, CFA, and state emergency services. And I've got to tell you that throughout the whole project, I called the SES Tasmania. And no one ever asked me, but one day someone did, and they said, what do you call the SES Tasmania for? And I said, because everyone forgets that they exist, because they do. If you see a map of Australia, they're never there. And Gareth Davis was the head of SES back in those days, and he was a very good friend for years. He's now retired down on the peninsula, and I hope he's well. But so... needed to be mindful of the fact that this had to be a multi-agency approach. So we had many meetings. Now, that came with a lot of difficulty because when we were talking about building new centres, which resulted in the car park at the Victoria Police Centre becoming the Intergraph site, police Intergraph site, and tally-ho, the fire brigade wanted red walls, the ambulance wanted blue and white, and the police weren't that fussed. And they were the sort of background things that we had to put up with and try and really
negotiate
how this is going to be put together because it was a huge, huge project. So as we walked through this whole thing, and I mean Ken Sutherland, because people said, oh, this won't work, the CAD won't work. Well, Ken Sutherland, the my techo, he actually had a big couple of coat hangers made an aerial on the toilet at the back of the Fenwick Street office. And we were driving around in a car in 1991 talking to each other through a computer. So we could do it. To be perfectly honest, in Victoria Police back in those days was very, very slow in implementing stuff. And a lot of it came to funding, but this was a fully funded project by the government, as I understand it, at that particular time. Okay, so we go through the situation with a lot of the people bidding for this or wishing to bid for this project, and, of course, the specifications were the most important part of the whole exercise. Now, the developing the specifications, we did the CAD side of it, but because it needed to be integrated, we were a party to the implementation of the whole package, if you like. You know, we had to do all the source codes had to be done and codes in terms of call signs and a whole range of things. It really is a huge, huge undertaking, as you could well imagine. And it was interesting, and I'll move ahead a little bit, because one of the interesting things is when IWS implemented this thing and cutting over and back, suggested we should have a complaint line, fax line for people to complain about it or give us feedback how it's working. So before we actually cut over officially, we were cutting in and back and asking for feedback. And I think, I can't remember exactly, but 85% of the complaints we got was when D24 was still operating. So that's how people can't handle change. The cutover, when we got to evaluating the project, okay, so we had a number of bidders, and these bidders, my particular role in that was this was a huge undertaking. We broke the project up into about seven different areas, if you wish. In my particular area, I was in charge of evaluating the overall project implementation and their ability to handle it. And we had, and I'll use the example, IBM. IBM's response to the tender was two cabinets full of documents and a summary document. Now, the number one criteria in the whole exercise, and I'm using IBM, it was other people as well, I think Fujitsu, PRC, and one or two others who I can't remember. The main criteria was that they had to demonstrate that they had the ability and could show us where they'd handled a multi-agency response for their communications and computer-aided dispatch. And IBM couldn't. I mean, day one, I went through their proposal, their summary, and it didn't get passed there. And it also happened to one or two of the others, I think Fujitsu and whatever, and I was in at the best office, and I said to Jeff Spring, I said, they don't conform. They just simply don't conform. Well, that created a huge hullabaloo with people ringing the chief commissioner and Jeff Spring and the parliamentarians and all sorts of things. But I must say, they stood by the whole thing, and they didn't conform with the criteria and the specifications. Simple as that. Mm-hmm. So we went through the whole process. Now, during this particular process, I can't mention names or whatever, but I was offered a bribe. I was offered a very, very substantial bribe, and I didn't take kindly to that. It happened at my office, and I actually said to this particular person, I said, I'm going out to the toilet. We're having a few beers. I said, I'm going out to the toilet, and I'll come back, and I want you to retract that statement. And they didn't. So I contacted Jeff Spring, and there was a meeting, and they retracted that particular statement there. But, I mean, I'd been through that RACV inquiry where I was also offered a bribe, which wasn't a good idea, because I think my comment at the time, and I was wired up, was I'm going to lock you up for insulting words. I don't think I could be bought. So there was, it was a very, very sought-after project by everyone, and I'm not just targeting IBM. I'm using them as an example. And to qualify that, I mean, Sue Drakeford was the principal at IBM we were dealing with, and I hope Sue's coming next Wednesday. We were really good friends. But I just didn't conform, and Fujitsu didn't conform. PRC partly conformed, and there was one or two others. But that was the
Rob, was the bribe monetary?
Oh yes.
Yeah, okay. And a very substantial amount, obviously.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, the project to whoever won it was worth millions of dollars. Millions of dollars. Okay. And during the whole thing, there was quite a number of times where there was political interference or people within government were probably playing favourites to some areas of the technology industries, and this kept getting feedback to us, and we just totally ignored it, and we didn't take any of it on. We didn't bother answering most of it or trying to defend it, because we wouldn't be doing our job. We just got on and did the job.
Yep.
Okay, so we cut over in 1997, I think it was. And one of the things that lives in my memory is when we finally got to the Intergraph was selected as the winning bidder to do the whole lot. That was along with a number of other co-suppliers like Motorola and, you know, for radios, and there was a whole range of different suppliers, dozens of them, in fact. And one of the things we had to deal with, and I remembered, there was, if people would understand, we had 128 interfaces to the system, including like the education department, all the schools. There's a whole range of all these interfaces that hitherto logged into or connected with SES, with the ambulance services, the fire brigade and whatever. So we had to manage all of those connections. And it came to the day of cutover, and I was the cutover controller for the services, all the services, and a fellow by the name of Brian Fitzgerald was the cutover controller for Intergraph. Well, I can tell you that was really, really a pressure cooker. We're cutting over, cutting back then. For example, what we had to do was I'd organised for probably, I don't know, 70, 80, 100 people to ring in from phone boxes, on mobile phones, from home phones and whatever, to make sure that they could get through to the system. So we cut over, and then the fun started. Now, at that stage, I was the chief inspector with Victoria Police, working for Victoria Police, and I developed a very strong friendship, if you like, with all of the suppliers that we dealt with. But I, back in those days, as I said, there was 168 Intergraph systems across the world, but this was the first build, own, operate system. And moving right ahead to later on, in case I forget, after I was with Intergraph, and the reason I came to be there is they to be perfectly honest, they headhunted me on a number of occasions to become their liaison manager and deal with all the services, basically as a troubleshooter. And I resisted all that. And for not just monetary reasons, but for other reasons, I did go there. And I can tell you it was 5 years, some of the best years of my life. I thoroughly enjoyed it. They were an absolute delight to work for.
They're an American company.
They are an American company. But moving down, I'm going ahead a few years, but I used to have meetings with, particularly with Neil Comrie on occasions, and we'd have all these issues and problems. And Neil was fantastic. I knew Neil pretty well, and we were in the Army together back in the day. And moving ahead a few years, and I'll come back, but a few years I met with him, and he said to me, he said, Rob, the new contract needs to start being negotiated soon. It falls due in about 6 months' time. And I said, Neil, I've got news for you, and I was with Indigraph at the time. They do not wish to renew the contract.
Oh, okay.
And he looked at me. He really didn't say anything. He just looked at me, and I said, Neil, the reason is that there's 168 other sites across the world, and not one of them is a problem. And I said, there's one build, own, operate, which is operated by Indigraph, which is a huge problem and bad press, all sorts of things. Why the hell would they want to renew it? And so they didn't. But on the way through, we had all sorts of problems, and I'll get to some of the political stuff in a minute and court issues. But business continuity, I did a business continuity plan. They had a consultant do a business continuity plan, which cost $80,000. Indigraph paid $80,000 to do it, and they gave it to me to review. And I took one look at it, and it was the greatest load of gobbledygook. I won't go into the reasons why, but I threw it in the bin. And I did I did it with a fellow by the name of Alphys Hines, who was another consultant, and he's, again, is still a good friend of mine. He's in the UK, and he's world-renowned, and he's very good. And as a result, in fact, the Indigraph opted me out in New Zealand, asked me to go over there and do their business continuity plan for their three major sites. So I spent 3 months over there doing that, which, again, was great experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And for reasons I'll tell you later, I got there and they'd just thrown IBM out of the country. This seems like an IBM beat-up. But it's not. It's just how things worked out. But they were persona non grata in New Zealand when I was there doing their business continuity plan. I'll probably get a phone call. But anyway, that was fact. And later on, they won the contract in Victoria, which I'll talk a little bit about. That was for the not for the communications project, but for the major supplier for the Victoria Police technology. The headline, I'll get to the headlines, and this is where I want people, those that listen are interested, to understand that there was so much misreporting about Indigraph. Now, I was there for just under five years, and one of my roles was to, or my significant role was to liaise with all the agencies, and I had lots of meetings and troubleshooting stuff and it was really a very great environment. It was quite friendly, and there were Indigraph made some horrible mistakes, but they were all explainable, and you could probably expect them to happen in the implementation of a project this size. But we worked them all out, but it got to the stage where we were. And I might add that one of my roles was I check all the briefs that went into the coroner's court where Indigraph, which involved all the services, may be implicated in the death or the near miss of someone. And so I reviewed a lot of the coronial reports and any briefs that went to Victoria Police and Metropolitan Ambulance Service, and I dealt with those. And whilst I was there, Indigraph did not have a 1% contribution to any death in Victoria. Now, that is despite headlines like Indigraph killed my son, which I'll talk about in a moment. And they were front page news. They were on the radio. Neil Mitchell was lambasting. And I remember.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, People that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Talking to Neil at one stage, and I invited him. I said, come and work your program from our control centre at the Victoria Police Centre. And I said, you'll see exactly what goes on. And what people also don't understand is, and it became very poignant at one stage, is about 60 or 70% of the operators that came across or worked at Intergraph as call takers and dispatchers were the same people that worked at D24. With years and years and years of experience. And at one stage, I took over the role as I was a bit Johnny come lately, fix everything. I was in charge of training. And the training for the people at Intergraph was far superior to any other training that D24 ever did. And it had to be because of the different technology. But it was very, very robust training. It was fantastic. The selection process was very focused, and I had a bit of a role to play in that, in selecting people. And the people that worked there were very, very great people, and they still are. And a lot of the issues that arose were in the paper were actually issues with the Triple O system and nothing to do with Intergraph. Intergraph had nothing to do with Triple O. Triple O took the
Can you just explain, because I don't understand what's the – because and if I don't, the listeners won't either. What's the difference between Intergraph and Triple O? What's the difference with them?
Okay, I'll step it through. So an incident occurs regardless of what service is required, and people ring Triple O, right? Mm. And a Triple O Telstra operator would answer the phone and they say, which service do you require? And they'd patch them through to whichever service was required. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened during this whole process was they were saying that calls were getting lost. So I think it was Graham Teeson. I'll talk a little bit about Graham at the moment. One of the things that Graham or we implemented was you'll hear now if you ring Triple O, the operator will hand over to the applicable service and say 17665. So it had an identifier, and that identifier was chronological. And what we found was that the people were saying they rang Triple O and it never got through and whatever. We checked, and 99.9% of them were rubbish. We also had lots of complaints where people said that they had to wait 30 minutes for an ambulance or 25 minutes for police, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this system was completely transparent. Everything was time-stamped. Every action was time-stamped. And as the control room manager, Graham Teeson, would check – and now Graham was an ex-chief inspector of Victoria Police. He also went across to Intergraph. And he went across as a control room manager and was fantastic in that role. In 2000, he did the Y2000 project, and I actually was the control room manager for Victoria, or the metropolitan area, for 12 months. So I sat in that chair, so I saw the same things as him. We'd get quite a few complaints about this, that, and the other, and because the system was so robust and so transparent, we could check it straight away. We could just go in, we could have a look at the time of the call, where it came from, and all of those sorts of things. And it was just rubbish. People were just building Intergraph up for no reason whatsoever, particularly some of the media. And yep. It got to the stage where I actually spoke to some of the media and I said, if you've got an issue, and Graham was the same, Graham Thiessen, I said, if you've got an issue, before you go to here and start waxing lyrical about this stuff, ring me. I'll get you an answer in 10 minutes, which I could. I'd just ring the centre and get straight through to the control room manager. He'd bring it up and I'd have the answer. And I said that would waylay a lot of this false information that's going out to the public, because all you're doing is reducing the public's perception of all the emergency services. Forget about Intergraph.
And their confidence in the system. Yeah,
And I'll give you some examples of some of the things that happened, because I am really still very angry. Because, for example, I got a call from the coroner's court. There was a gentleman there who would tell me if there was some exposure for Intergraph, all the services, to some degree, because I had a very good relationship with all the services as well. So I wasn't just, if you like, in brackets, protecting Intergraph. I also had the interest at heart of the services. However, sometimes the services took advantage of that, and there's many examples, but I'll give you one. No, I'll give you two or three. But one is I had a look at this brief that went into the coroner's court where this woman had got through to the police, called take a dispatcher, and said, I've been stabbed, my husband has stabbed me, I'm 7 months pregnant and I'm bleeding. Anyway, so she died, baby died, and I think the offender husband, I think he stabbed himself, I'm not sure if he died as well. And in the brief, I see that the police got the call at a certain time and they attended the address. They waited outside the front gate for 22 and a half minutes before they went in. They waited for the keys from from their son. And in the brief, the summary was that the Intergraph operator's voice lacked urgency. Well, did I get out of my tree? I've grabbed the copy of that and I've gone, and it was John Frame. I went and saw John. And I said, have a read of that. And he said, that's not real flash, is it? And I said, John, the guy that the dispatcher there is an ex-Intergraph caller. Dispatcher, sorry, who's done probably 70 or 80,000 calls during his 20-year career at D24, and he handled that call and dispatch the same as he handled the other 20 or 30,000. And indeed, part of their training and our training is you don't get hysterical and start screaming over the microphone. You just use your – it's just another job.
You remain calm
Of course you do. You don't want to get people excited. So that is just one example of how Intergraph could and Triple O could have been belted up because of people who didn't do their job properly. As simple as that. Just simply didn't do their job properly. Now, the one that really got me going, and Graham Thiessen lives very close to me, and we were talking about this yesterday, and it's one that I've got to be a little bit careful with, but at one particular stage it was on 3AW and all the TV stations of someone saying that Intergraph killed my son. Well, actually what happened was the ambulance couldn't find the location of this particular young fellow who was fitting and was turning blue and whatever, and the person who was his father, in brackets, had two phones in his place. One went to Benalla, the other one went to the call centre at Victoria Police Centre. And he was ringing on both saying, where's the ambulance, where's the ambulance? And he was. And we had all that time stamped. And during those calls and later at the coroner's court, he said he was giving his son mouth-to-mouth resuscitation trying to – well, he wasn't. Because the whole thing was documented and recorded, And okay. There wasn't time for him to do any of that sort of stuff. There wasn't even 10 seconds for him to do that, so he didn't. Okay. The other thing that happened was the ambulance couldn't find that address, and I know the area very well because it's where I used to live. And it's a dirt road between St Andrews and Yarra Glen. And the name of the street, I'll leave that out for the moment, but the ambulance, and it is difficult. It would be difficult because there's about three or four different streets or roads, dirt roads, that come off that particular location. So myself, Graham, and a lawyer who was from Clayton Utes, who represented Victoria Indigraf throughout all of these coronials when we had them and whatever, she was fantastic. She's now the chief magistrate. And we went out there and we surveyed the scene, took photographs and whatever. And I think it was Graham went out there a little bit earlier with his wife, and she got on his shoulders and had a look at the sign. And we all went there and had another look at the sign. And subsequently, I found the printer in Eltham who made the sign. And the sign was made a month after this incident where his son died, and paid for by not the council. This is whilst this matter was being heard at the coronial. So needless to say, I took that information, including a statement from the guy who made the sign and who paid it, and took it into the coroner's court and gave it to the counsel who was representing the family. And there was a very, very drastic change in direction.
I bet there was. Immediate.
Now, that's just an example, two examples of some of the stuff that happened, and there are dozens more. They're probably the two worst ones, I've got to say, but there were some others where people actually died and Indigraf was blamed. And as I said, when I was there, they weren't responsible for 1% of any fault at whatsoever at the coroner's court.
And, Rob, you being the sort of person you are, I have no doubt that if there was an issue, if an issue was identified in Intergraph, that you would have confronted it. It's not like you would never have ignored it, because you had to work out if something did go wrong, what went wrong and why, and to make sure it never happened again.
My attitude with all the services, and particularly with Indigraph, I said from day one, I said if we stuffed up, our hand goes up immediately, and it did. And there were times where we didn't cause any deaths, but there were problems where we were at fault, and there are many, many examples where Graham Thiessen or I put our hands up and said, yeah, geez, we stuffed that up, but what we're doing about it is this.
Yeah.
And some of the complaints were, oh, they went to the wrong place. Well, they did go to the wrong place because that was the place that they were given. Now, you've got to remember we had what's called caller line identification, CLI. So, in other words, if you rang from your home, for example, and saying that, an incident has happened, they would go to the address there if the phone went dead or whatever. All the services, not just the police, fire and ambulance would all go to that address because there's been an incident. But a lot of people didn't say, well, the incident isn't here. It's my daughter who lives in another suburb.
Oh, yeah.
So there were dozens of those sorts of complaints. So, and one thing that was really good with the system is hitherto, Indigraph, people would ring up, and I'll give you an example under the old system. I'm in Maroondah Highway. What suburb? Oh, I don't know, because it becomes Whitehorse Road. It's Maroondah Highway. Then it becomes something else. With the Indigraph system, the call taker would say, well, hang on, whereabouts are you? I don't know. Oh, can you see a McDonald's? Give me some sort of indication of what you can see. And they pinpointed on the map. So the accuracy improved 100% of being able to send resources to the appropriate places. So these things were very frustrating indeed. And again, with Neil Mitchell at one particular stage, Jeff Kennett was on with Neil, and it was at the high point of Indigraph getting bolted up, particularly by 3RW, I've got to say. And it was predetermined that I'd ring in, and Jeff Kennett was there. And I started to talk about a particular incident from memory. I'm testing my memory here at the moment. I can't remember what it was about. And Neil Mitchell hung up on me. From memory, he just discontinued the call for some reason. And I think Mr. Kennett said something like, well, why did you do that? And Mr. Bailey actually knows a lot about this sort of stuff because he did know what was going on in the background. So I'm building up 3AW a bit, but they were just part of the whole media throng that were totally incorrect about 90% of what they were saying. They didn't, whilst they were there, they didn't get any of it right. There was the odd one where there was a minor glitch in the system and they blow it up to completely out of proportion. But that was, you know, that was sort of something that we had to put up with all the time, and probably a good example or reason as to why Intergraph didn't want to renew the contract, because they were held to account for everything that happened. Whereas if they had just implemented the system and provided the technology, etc., they wouldn't come into account at all under any sort of account at all. So that's why they didn't renew it. Now, they're still using the Intergraph system and the mapping that was produced by Victoria. It was actually the Treasury Department back in the day, and it's still used, as I say, about 168 sites around the world. You know, I think you mentioned there was something like 3,000 or 4,000 events a day, but that was the card system. Well, I remember when things can go wrong, they did. We got belted up fiercely. It was New Year's Eve 2000, I think it was 1999, and it was New Year's Eve. And we advised all the services that we were going to have a downtime of an hour to reload a new part of the system and whatever, which happens occasionally, and we go into manual mode at that particular time. And what we didn't know, and no one knew, is we had one of the biggest storms of all time. And we struggled. We really struggled. But having said that, we're also able to, because one of the things that we wanted in the specification was that both centres had to be interoperable. So with training, we had people trained at both centres to take over. The each of the services. So, for example, we had state emergency services ran their own system from South Melbourne, but we also had a pod at the Intergraph Centre, or the Victoria Police Centre, where we could take over, which we did on occasions. So they were totally interoperable, and the training represented our ability to do that. But one of the problems we had was when I was talking in the political scene about this, people were saying, well, you know, what are you going to do if there's a major incident? And this comes to the business continuity plan. And what they didn't understand is, oh, what you do is just you get people to go to the other centre and whatever. And I said, well, if you've got an explosion of some sort of degree, people are killed. So what do you think, being my smart ass self? I said, we haven't got blow-up dolls that we take out of the cupboard and put them in a call-taking and dispatching situation. So it was hiding to nothing for poor old Intergraph at that particular time. But
Rob, can I ask a question? Why would you use New Year's Eve as the date? And I don't know if it was you that had the choice, but New Year's Eve would be one of the busiest days of the nights of the year, or days and nights of the year. Why would you use New Year's Eve as the changeover of systems?
It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and all indications were it was going to be totally quiet. It was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're right. And all the information we had was it was going to be a quiet night in terms of weather and all that sort of stuff. So, and we're talking about SES. It was an SES issue. It wasn't police, fire, or ambulance. It was an SES issue.
So
those things can happen. The other thing that Intergraph did wrong is doing the business continuity plan that I did, and this is where Intergraph made a mess of something. I pointed out that they had a single point of failure at Tally Ho, which was the ambulance fire CFA. And I said, you've got a single point of failure there insofar as there's only one telephone system coming into the centre, which was from East Melbourne. And I said, you've got to duplicate that on your switchboard, because if something happens, you've got failure. You've got no calls coming in. They said, oh, no. Basically, they didn't do it for whatever reason. Day two, a little wombat was cutting up a bit of something somewhere, and and guess what? No telephone system. So another $100,000, we duplicated the system. So there were some simple errors that should have been attended to by Integraph that weren't to start with. But to their credit, when we ascertained that there was something that was amiss, they fixed it. And quite often it was at their own expense, despite the fact that on occasions I think there was very strong argument for financial commitment from some of the other – one or more of the other services. And there was – you know, that was argued at a different level than mine. But in terms of my evaluation of that situation, I thought Integraph operated very fairly. The other thing that happened during that whole exercise was the assistant state auditor at that time, a fellow by the name of Bhagwananath, issued his annual report of the assistant state auditor. And bagged Integraph unmercifully. I have never been so angry in all my life. I read through that. We all did, and it was that bad. We didn't bother even challenging it. It was just all lie. It was made up, and it was supposed to be apolitical. It wasn't, in my view. But they're the sorts of things that Integraph had to get up. And what I want to come out of this whole thing is that there was very, very good people running this system who suffered a lot of stress. A lot of our operators were too scared to wear their Integraph uniforms home because of the bad press. They were getting harassed and harangued by people on their way home to and from on public transport. And they were just the good people at the other end of the phone. So it's always been on my chest, and that's why I said to you I'd like to do this, because I want people to understand that they're in Victoria, and look, I've been to Tasmania, New Zealand, and looked at overseas communication systems and the people, the training and the technology. And when Integraph, during the 90s and 2000s, when I was involved with Integraph, Victoria had the best of everything. And overseen by people like Jeff Spring, who was fantastic, and the people at Integraph, like Peter Simmons and Gary Berto and whatever, were fantastic people, and had the good of the heart of the general public and their staff, and people got penalised for that. But anyway, that's life.
I just lost you for a minute there, Rob. Sorry about that. So with all these complaints that made it impossible, I suppose, for Integraph to continue, like they lasted 5 years. But do you think it was a particular cell of people? Like, I'm wondering, why did Victoria get so much bad publicity for Integraph when you said they were all over the world? What was the difference with Victoria to anywhere else?
The difference was, it was a build, own, operate. So they built it, they owned it, and they operated it. The other 168 sites, they provided all the technology and walked away. So in other words, if they did that here, the police, fire and ambulance would have the whole system and they would run it. So they were the fall guy. Because it was political, they were in the gun. From day one, they were in the gun. They were an easy target for everyone. Just think about it. If it hadn't been Integraph running that whole thing, I doubt that you would have heard a word, because you wouldn't have. Well, you wouldn't. It just wouldn't have happened. But because it was a build, own, operate, they were an easy target. They were a really easy target, and to some extent, the services, police, fire, and ambulance, at some stage, used them as the fall guy for their own ineptness. And I saw that on plenty of occasions, and it was something they did because the opportunity was there. And, you know, again, I can only reiterate that whilst I was there, I mean, I was flat out all the time and trying to assist all the services to get the best outcome that we could all get, despite all the interference. And I think you'll find that people who are involved with Integraph from the other services, largely, in fact, all the people I dealt with, and I still talked a lot to them, thought it was great, and they were really wrapped with the service and the system. It was the outsiders who took aim at us, and some people who took the opportunity to put the blame on Integraph, including the media.
Actually, in fact, in in relation to that, I remember I did a bit of research about Intergraph for today. And one of the things I did notice was that Danny Walsh, who was the Police Association president at the time, he said that generally the members were very happy with Intergraph. So the members were happy with it. It just sounds like it was the people outside that were trying to make it as difficult as they could, obviously, and they didn't want Intergraph to have, you know, like the outside influences, because inside police thought it was really, it was working really well.
Well, you know why? Because with a lot of the incidents that Victoria Police attended and the ambulance service and the fire brigade attended, we had indelible time stamping, chronological, sequential records of exactly what happened. So when they were preparing reports and briefs of evidence and whatever, we had it all for them. Mm. Prior to that, they had nothing. They had the cards that they gave to the operators and maybe some voice stuff that went us over the air, but that would, some of that wouldn't even be time-stamped. In fact, it wasn't. Some of it was. It was recorded and time-stamped on the reel-to-reel tapes. But this was transparent, time-stamped evidence. So hitherto they didn't have that. So the investigators were wrapped, and so were the run-of-the-mill police. They'd, you know, attend a fatal accident, and, you know, if you've ever done a brief for a fatal accident, unfortunately I have, it is a very, very involved process. Now, once Intergraph came on board, they were able to get everything in touch of a button. And if they wanted records, and if we wanted – the other thing that – and thank you for raising it. The other thing that hitherto wasn't available was statistics. You know, the amount of calls, the time they took for calls and whatever. Largely, none of this stuff was ever available beforehand. All of a sudden, you've got someone that is putting their hand up to take responsibility for all of this sort of stuff, and it was transparent. So if we did stuff up, we did. And there was times where we didn't meet, again, I reiterate, they didn't meet their requirements under the contracts. But, again, I go back to the stage where instead of getting one call for a fatal accident or a bad accident, you'd get 100.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's obviously going to have an effect on your time stamping and your records. So there was a whole range of other things and the statistics showed where we were going well and when we were going poorly. And one of my roles was to investigate, or our roles, but mine too, was to investigate, and particularly when Graham Thiessen was the control room manager, and then I did it for 12 months. One of my major roles was out on the floor actually checking up on calls, go and listen to something. If a major event was happening, you'd have the police contingent there who had Mark Eaton headed up for a while, and Peter Ferguson. Peter Ferguson was their control room manager. And guess what? He's coming Wednesday as part of our little reunion.
I thought he might be.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. So it was a team effort. So you'd have a major incident happening, and when I was there as the control room manager, I'd be there, Peter Ferguson would be there, or Mark Eden when he was in the chair, and it would be run by some very, very experienced people. We had some major events where we provided a room, and we had the helicopter, and we were direct. You know, we had, and that's a really good story. We had a direct feed from the helicopter to the control center. But that, and I did warn command when we ran one of these incidents from there. I said we have to be very careful here because I'd already done similar stuff in another theater of war, where you've got people that are actually in the control room watching this live, and you've got people on the ground, and they are countermanding people on the ground. Mm. So what you had was conflict. And I warned them, and we found out very quickly that I was right. And I said, you've got to be very careful that you don't create a bigger nuisance than what you've got. So we developed some strategies about how that's handled. You can't go over the top of those people that are on the ground, because you just develop utter confusion.
Oh, yeah.
So all of a sudden we had all of these technological abilities, and we had to learn how to manage them in an operational sense. So, but it was exciting. Look, I loved every minute of it. It was a vibrant environment where something was happening all the time. you know, we had the people forget we're dealing with human beings, and we had a lot of people that developed stressful situations, and they had, you know, in the ambulance sector where people were managing very bad situations where people died, and we had to provide counselling for them, which we did. There was, and the training, and reiterate the training about how it happens. There was a whole dynamic situation in these centres, and you know, I took a few people through there. Oh, and it reminds me of one story. Part of what we did back in the early days, before we cut over to Intergraph, is I took a number of overseas people who, you know, the bidders and whatever, to have a look at the current D24 system. And one of the guys, he was from PRC, which is a major, major company in the US. Lovely people. And they probably came the closest to Intergraph in the end, but they didn't win it. And we walked through and I said, well, what do you think? And he said, nice museum.
Yep, that'd be right.
very, very funny. Well, we might end it on that. I've got obviously some other stories, but I think we've probably gone over time.
Yeah, and we will. Yeah, I'll let you go. But I was just going to say, you know, it hasn't changed a lot, Rob, because Esther, the 000, they still get criticised. They get hammered. If somebody dies and fair enough, but what happens, I think, when somebody dies or something drastic happens, it's almost like somebody has to be blamed, or somebody's looking for somebody to blame. And, you know, like if there's delays with the ambulance, delays with the police, for attendance. So I think the complaints will always, they're always going to be there, but it's how you handle them, isn't it?
Well, it gets back to the age old, you get to the coroner's court and, Narelle, it's all about money. When at the end of the day, someone's died or seriously injured or whatever, it gets to the blame game and everyone wants to cover their bum and everything gets lost in minutiae. And I saw that right through my whole role. And I'll reiterate, in my 5 years there, Intergraph did not have a 1% contribution to anyone's death. And when I still say, you know, people know, and I say, oh, yeah, I work for Intergraph. Oh, geez, that must have been bad. And all these comments, and I say, it's five of the best years of my life, and they're a fantastic company. Because they were, and I've still and the whole thing is wrapped up into what I've said, you know, today, is that people from all walks of life that were involved in this project, from all the some of the services, a couple of them have died, so they can't come, but from Best, from Motorola, from Intergraph, from police, from fire, they're all coming next Wednesday for a reunion and have a few drinks and a cup of tea and whatever. Mm. Now, that says everything.
I know it does. I couldn't agree more. Have a great lunch next week. I'm sorry, but I'm busy. But can we finish off, Rob? I don't know if we should, but I'm going to. Can we finish off with that joke you told me at the start? and then we'll just say goodbye and thank you very much for your service.
I was saying to Noel, we're talking about our domestic situations, and I related my doctor said to me not long ago, he said, how's your sex life? And I said, I'm looking forward to it.
Goodbye, Rob.
See you, Noel.
Oh, Rob, that is fantastic. Thank you, everybody. Oh, that is just the best line. Anyway, thanks, Rob. In all seriousness, thank you very much for everything. And I do hope you have a lovely lunch next week.
Yeah, thanks. Looking forward to it. I'll get people to have a listen to it first and they'll all have a crack at me.
Goodbye.
See ya.
See ya. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.